Good afternoon, and welcome to the June meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you from the Midcoast of Maine, and a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum, which was founded 34 years ago, 1983, by a small group of area residents with a special interest in U.S. foreign policy and our role in international affairs. We meet on a monthly basis to hear retired foreign policy officials, academics, journalists, and international businessmen discuss important foreign policy issues. Our membership, which is currently about 250, includes not just those who are interested in foreign affairs, but as well many who have lived and worked abroad and have considerable expertise about many of the issues discussed. For additional information, please visit our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker Trita Parsi, who spoke, he was here, I think, about 3 or 4 years ago. He's an award-winning author and the 2010 recipient of the Grawemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order. He's the founder and president of the National Iranian American Council, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization through which Iranian Americans can participate in American civic life. Is a vocal proponent of dialogue and engagement between the U.S. and Iran, which Parsi consistently has argued would enhance our national security, American national security, by helping to stabilize the Middle East and bolster the moderates in Iran. He's the author of Treacherous Alliance from 2007, his 2012 book, A Single Roll of the Dice, and a new book, which literally just came out today. It was the first time he has seen it. It's available, naturally. We have it for sale. The first place in the United States to have this book for sale. Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. He's served as an adjunct professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins, SAIS, an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute, and is a policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. He's fluent in Farsi, English, and Swedish. His articles on Middle East affairs have been published in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the LA Times, the Financial Times, the Nation, the American Conservative, the Jerusalem Post, and others. He's a frequent guest on CNN, PBS, NPR, BBC, and Al Jazeera. So today we are delighted to welcome once again Trita Parsi to discuss what's going on in Iran.
Thank you so much. It's a great, great pleasure being back here at the Midcoast Forum. Last time I was here was November 2013. I remember that because it was right in between two rounds of nuclear negotiations. It was the one session in which the French moved the goalpost and the US had expected to get a deal and unfortunately didn't happen. And back then, we didn't know at the end of the day whether there would be a deal or not, whether there would be an agreement that would stop Iran's nuclear program, or whether we would be drifting towards war. Fortunately, we can say now that there hasn't been a war, but we are not yet in a position in which we can say that we have lost an enemy. And that's actually what the book is about. Throughout the negotiations, I found myself in a rather unique position because I was advising the Obama administration on the talks. And at the same time, I had access to the Iranian negotiators. It wasn't unusual for me to be able to be at the White House on a Wednesday to get a briefing on the state of the negotiations and then fly to Europe a couple of days later and then end up having a two-hour private conversation with the Iranian foreign minister in his private hotel room about their perspective on these things. And that front seat position that I had, I thought would be valuable to document what was happening and document their calculations and their considerations and their fears and their incentives and motives and put it into a book. And that's exactly what this is. Now, I wanted to also show what a tremendously difficult effort it was to be able to reach this deal, but also what it did achieve. But it's important to understand that the nuclear issue and these negotiations at the end of the day were not just about the nuclear issue. It was about so much more. Its consequences truly ranged from war to peace. and it took place in the midst of a geopolitical earthquake. To understand that better, I'd like to go back a couple years in time. April 2012. The U.S. was amassing sanctions and pressure on the Iranians. The Iranians were expanding their nuclear program. The Israelis were on an almost weekly basis insinuating that they might take military action and start a war that the U.S. at the time certainly did not want to have. In the midst of this, April 2011, a very unusual group of officials gathered in a small European city to try to find an exit out of what surely seemed to be a path that could lead to nothing but war. Several Iranian ambassadors were in the room, including some of the nuclear negotiators, several U.S. officials, including a U.S. general, and perhaps most surprisingly, a high-level Israeli delegation. Now, at the time, the Iranians and the Israelis were not even talking to each other, and the Iranians weren't even recognizing Israel. So the idea of finding several of these officials in the same room was truly a unique moment. But the surprises didn't end there. What was said was perhaps the most surprising part. This is not about enrichment. It was never about enrichment. The room was completely silent when this high-level Israeli official looked at the Iranians and uttered these words. For years, we had been told that Iran's nuclear program was an existential threat. Iran's refusal to cease enrichment of uranium was enough to be able to prompt the Israelis to take a military action in order to prevent this existential threat from manifesting itself. But now an Israeli official, directly looking at the Iranians, said that this actually was not about enrichment. Instead, he indicated, Israel needed to see what he called a sweeping attitude change on behalf of the Iranians. So Israel was not going to accept that Iran did not recognize Israel and questioned its legitimacy. And it was not going to allow the United States to come to terms with Iran unless Iran first came to terms with Israel. If the United States proceeded to strike a nuclear deal with Iran, regardless of its details, and by that ending the isolation policy of Iran, without at the same time changing Iran's attitude towards Israel, it would leave Israel abandoned, facing Iran alone in the region. Israel, it was declared, could not accept this and would do everything in its power to stand in the way of a nuclear deal for that very reason. It was a moment of honesty, and it was a moment of outmost clarity of what this issue actually was about. To understand the message of the Israeli official, we need to go back another two decades. 1991, the Soviet Union had just collapsed, and the United States had crushed Iraq in the Persian Gulf War. Suddenly, you had a geopolitical earthquake, both on the global and on a regional level. On the global scale, we had a new world order where the United States was the sole superpower. But on a regional scale, the old order had fallen apart, but it was not clear what the new order that would be ushered in would be. With Iraq defeated, the Soviet Union more or less out of the picture, Iran and Israel emerged as two of the most powerful states in that region. Now, in the 1980s and even the 70s and 60s, these two countries had enjoyed a very strong clandestine relationship because they both shared common threats. Strong Arab nationalist countries such as Egypt under Nasser or Iraq under Saddam Hussein, and the Soviet Union. Now, both of those threats were gone. And as a result, a new geopolitical constellation had emerged in the Middle East. One in which they were thrown into a very intense rivalry for defining how the next order of the region would look like. Israel cleverly moved and managed to convince the United States that the real threat to the region now came from Iran, and that for Israel to take the risk of seeking peace with the Palestinians
the United States needed to contain and isolate Iran in order to give Israel leeway to find a peace with the Arab side. The Clinton administration bought into this, and they put into place a policy that was called the dual containment policy. A new order was established in the region based on Israel, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt's centrality, and based on the exclusion of Iran and Iraq. This new order was extremely beneficial, of course, for the Israelis and the Saudis. For Iran, it was a huge blow. They had hoped that they would now emerge out of their isolation caused by themselves through the radicalization of their revolution and be able to find a better relationship with the United States. Instead, the United States moved to intensify Iran's isolation. The Iranian response was to try to make this policy as costly as possible for the United States. And the weakest link in that policy was the peace process. To the extent that peace between Israel and Palestine could not be found, it would be more and more difficult for the United States to be able to ensure that this order would be sustained and that it wouldn't be too costly to sustain it. But despite everything Iran did to cause the collapse of this American-led order that was built on its isolation, it wasn't Iran that managed to destroy that order. It was the United States itself. In 2003, the Bush administration invades Iraq in the hope of changing that government and also taking out all other hostile governments in the region, reshaping them in its own image, and create a new order in the region in which those hostile governments no longer would have a place. But the Bush administration failed miserably in this effort. The invasion of Iraq did not create a new order, it just destroyed the old order. And ever since, the Middle East has essentially been in a state of orderlessness. There is no dominant power that can enforce its will and enforce the new rules of engagement for the region as a whole. And more importantly, because the Iraq war ended up being so costly, it weakened the United States to the extent that it no longer had the capacity of enforcing a new geopolitical equilibrium on the region. For Israel and Saudi Arabia, this was a disaster. They were the main winners of the old order. Their security was guaranteed and, to a large extent, paid for by the United States. They enjoyed maximum maneuverability under the protection of the United States. For Iran, this was a blessing in disguise. Its two main enemies, Saddam Hussein and the Taliban in Afghanistan, had been eliminated, and this more or less unleashed Iran's capacity to be able to spread its influence. And the U.S. had weakened itself so it could no longer return to a policy of an all-out isolation that would be effective. But as long as the United States continued to refuse negotiations with Tehran, the Iranians could not lock in these new beneficial geopolitical circumstances. It needed a crisis to force the United States to the negotiating table. A negotiating settlement that, by definition, would grant Iran the recognition that the United States isolation policy had deprived it of. And the Iranians wanted this recognition for the very same reasons that the Israelis did not want the Iranians to get it, because that recognition would put the Iranians in a position to be able to have an impact on the future balance of power in the region. Ironically, the Iranians and the Israelis ended up using the same instrument to achieve their objectives, Iran's nuclear program. To the Israelis, this menacing program was used to make unrealistic demands that would ensure that no compromise could be found. And that is the demand that Iran have absolutely no enrichment at all, zero enrichment, zero centrifuges. And without a compromise, a threat that had been defined as an existential threat would ensure that the United States inevitably would be forced to take military action against Iran. The balance of power that would follow such a war would clearly be in Israel's favor. The Iranians, however, had a different calculation with the same instrument. By pushing forward with their nuclear program, it could bring about war. But precisely because war had been so costly for the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan, and because the American public was so tired of more military engagements, it could also bring the United States to the negotiating table and force it to recognize that Iran is a major power in the region, and the balance that would follow such a negotiation, the Iranians calculated, would be quite beneficial to Tehran. The crux of the dilemma for the United States was how could the U.S. prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon without going to war, without having Israel start a war that would suck the U.S. into it, and without letting the Iranians be in a position in which they could define the new order of the region after the U.S. had negotiated. Now, the Bush administration refused negotiations. The U.S. was the source of international legitimacy in their view, and if they talked to the Iranians, that legitimacy would rub off on the Iranians. Moreover, diplomacy was seen as a sign of weakness, and it was preferred to simply strong-arm the other countries into submission. A submission that Washington wanted, and this is important to understand, was zero enrichment, absolutely no centrifuge spinning in Iran. The Bush administration imposed sanctions, tried to isolate Iran in order to change Iran's cost-benefit calculus. It was a policy that was utterly unsuccessful. In 2003, Iran had roughly 164 centrifuges. By the time Bush left office, Iran had 8,000 centrifuges. Iran had zero stockpile of low-enriched uranium in 2003, and he had 1,576 by the time Bush left office. 1,200 kilos is roughly what you need to build a nuclear weapon. That was the result of not negotiating and just relying on pressure. Now, Obama campaigned on a promise to reinstate diplomacy at the center of American statecraft. And Iran had become the poster child of his promise of negotiating. As you remember, he said he would negotiate with the Venezuelans, he would negotiate with the Cubans, with the Iranians. Nothing was as sensitive as the idea of negotiating with Iranians. And a promise that under normal circumstances would have guaranteed his failure in the elections as a result of the American public's rejection of the Bush worldview as well as tiredness of war, it actually secured him a stunning victory in the elections. But diplomacy was much harder than Obama had anticipated. The first attempt was made in 2009, and that failed. It led to nothing. And very soon, within a year, Obama found himself in the same position as the Bush administration. The only tools he had at his disposal was cyber warfare, sabotage, and sanctions, all aimed at slowing down the Iranian program while at the same time raising the cost for the Iranians in order to cripple their economy to force them to capitulate on this issue. He did never articulate a zero enrichment objective, but nor did he ever reject that objective. He kept it unstated in order to give himself maximum maneuverability. But precisely because he had tried diplomacy, unlike President Bush, and precisely because he enjoyed international credibility, again, unlike the Bush administration, he did succeed in getting a very large number of other countries to impose sanctions on Iran and actually impose on the Iranians the toughest sanctions regime any country had been subjected to henceforth. That included the Europeans cutting off all oil purchases from Iran. That included imposing sanctions on Iran's central bank and essentially cutting off Iran entirely from the world international financial system. The day after the Senate voted in those sanctions, Iran's currency dropped 30% in one day. The absence of the oil purchases further reduced Iran's power and economic growth. In fact, its GDP shrunk 25% as a result of this massive, massive economic pressure. And for a moment, it looked as if the objective of capitulation actually was in the cards. After all, for how long could the Iranians withstand this amount of pressure? But Obama had underestimated the Iranians. While the economic pain clearly hurt them, it did not break them. Nor was Iran without a response. Just as it had escalated its nuclear program in response to the Bush administration's refusal to negotiate, it now further escalated its nuclear program in response to these new sanctions. If the sanctions were aimed at changing Iran's cost-benefit calculation, well, expanding the nuclear program was aimed at changing Washington's cost-benefit analysis. In the end, the result was that the U.S. was inching closer and closer towards crippling Iran's economy. The Israelis were inching closer and closer to starting a war, and the Iranians were inching closer and closer to securing a nuclear weapon. The question was, which clock was ticking the fastest? Was it the sanctions clock? Was it the Israeli clock? Or was it Iran's nuclear clock? Even if capitulation, however, could be achieved, the Obama administration recognized that it wouldn't be able to get that unless they had the opportunity to sit down with the Iranians face-to-face in direct negotiations that had the blessing of Iran's supreme leader. So by mid-July 2012, the Iranians and the Americans met at a secret location in the Kingdom of Oman in the Persian Gulf, arranged by no small part by then-Senator John Kerry. The American objective with these completely secret talks, very few people, in fact, about five people in the White House knew about them, was to A, assess how close were the Iranians to capitulating, and two, was this an authoritative channel to Iran's supreme leader? The Iranians came to the negotiating table with a completely different set of objectives. They came there thinking the United States was about to capitulate on the enrichment issue. And for a day and a half, they were spending it simply giving the Americans various formulations of how the U.S. could accept enrichment in Iran. Everything was rejected by the U.S. side. The U.S. negotiators had no authority to even discuss those issues of substance. They were only there to be able to size up the Iranians. There were two main negotiators from the U.S. side. One was Puneet Talwar, the other one was Jake Sullivan, who was later on a key advisor to Hillary Clinton and believed to have become Hillary Clinton's national security advisor if Clinton had won the elections. The meeting was a failure. The Omanis had put in a lot of effort to try to get the U.S. and Iran to the table. They had managed to get this channel to a very large part because they were the ones who secured the release of three American hikers who had been imprisoned in Iran, and they were now using this channel to do what they believe was an effort to prevent war. A second meeting could not be scheduled because the United States had elections in November of that year. But by January 2013, a new sense of urgency emerged. By January 2012, a year earlier, the United States estimated that Iran's breakout capability was 12 months. That's the amount of time it would take the Iranians from making a decision to build a bomb to having a bomb. By January 2013, Iran's breakout capability was 8 weeks. That was the result of the Iranians aggressively expanding their nuclear program in response to the sanctions. It started to become increasingly clear to the president that if nothing changed, the Iranian nuclear clock was ticking the fastest. And if an exit wasn't found, it wasn't Iran's capitulation that would be in the cards, but rather either the United States accepting Iran building a nuclear weapon or the United States going to war. A second meeting was scheduled in Oman. This time, the United States did not send mid-level officials whose names no one had heard of before. Instead, they sent some of the top negotiators, including Bill Burns, who was the number two at the State Department at the time, as well as Bob Einhorn, who was one of the senior nuclear negotiators and who had a very strong background in nonproliferation. The Iranians sent an equivalent delegation, and this time around, they spent about 2 or 3 days. The significance of this meeting cannot be understated. For the first time, the United States, in very, very carefully worded formulation, put the idea of accepting enrichment in Iran on the table. And they did so recognizing that if there wasn't a breakthrough, and if it didn't change its position from zero or the ambiguity, this would be heading towards a war. Now, the Iranians ever being so suspicious of the United States, for them this was not enough. They needed the formulation in writing. The United States could not put this in writing, because the fear was that if this was put in the writing, then the Iranians could just pocket this concession without giving anything in return. And it would be leaked, and it would create all sets of kind of problems. After the negotiations, the U.S. team went in to brief the Sultan of Oman on how the negotiations had gone. They explained to him what happened, including what offer they had made on the enrichment issue. Later on, the Iranians came in, and the same briefing was given, and the Iranians complained that the U.S. had not recognized enrichment because it was not put in writing. So a new idea emerged. The origins of it is not entirely clear, but it shows some of the ingenuity of diplomacy that was taking place. The gulf between Iran and the United States was largely a gulf of distrust. Neither side trusted the other. and neither side could go back home and say, well, the other side said that they would do this. So who on this planet had the trust of both sides? Who was a person who actually could fill in that gap? There's not a lot of candidates, I'm sure you can imagine. Essentially, there's probably only one, and that gentleman is the Sultan of Oman. He has a very strong relations with the supreme leader of Iran for historic reasons. And, of course, Oman is a very strong and loyal ally of the United States. The idea came that instead of the United States putting this in writing to the Iranians, the United States would put this in writing to the Omanis. In writing, the United States would commit itself to Oman that it would be accepting a solution based on Iran getting to keep enrichment on its soil as long as Iran did a whole set of other things. The Omanis would then not take the letter, but the Sultan himself, in between his chemotherapy, would fly to Tehran, sit down face to face with the supreme leader of Iran, and convey to him, they told me they will accept it. And the Iranians would then be in a position, if they rejected it, to say that we don't believe the Sultan of Oman. It did the trick. And the Iranians realized that this was the breakthrough that they had waited for. Of course, in return, the United States required significant restrictions on their program, significant transparency. But this is what opened up the negotiations. Then the entire world got very, very lucky. Elections were held in Iran, and the most moderate candidate on the ballot, Rouhani, was elected, who earlier on had tried to negotiate with the United States, had failed, and had been essentially persona non grata within Iran's political establishment, accusing him of being a traitor for the concessions he had offered the United States. He now became president. His foreign minister became a gentleman who spent more time in the United States than in Iran, with a doctorate from Denver University, Javad Zarif. Neither one of these two individuals had any idea about the secret negotiations, and they had no idea that the U.S. had actually taken steps to accept enrichment while Ahmadinejad was still president of Iran. Zarif had prepared a diplomatic strategy because in the campaign, Rouhani had said that he would negotiate. That negotiation plan did not include the United States. It only included negotiations with the Europeans. They did not think that they would be given the okay from the supreme leader of Iran to do so. They were in complete shock finding out what had happened. August, September, the U.S. and Iran negotiates in Oman and then also in New York. And by November 2013, an interim deal is struck in which Iran's progress on the nuclear program is completely capped. By that time, incidentally, Iran had 22,000 centrifuges. He had 10,000 kilos of low-enriched uranium. That was now put a cap on. And then, for another 2 years or two or so years, a little bit less, intense negotiations ensued to find a final agreement, which was then struck in July 2015. It was a moment of tremendous surprise to many because people did not expect that the United States and Iran actually would be able to find an agreement. Many people didn't believe the Iranians would ever show up and negotiate directly with the United States. And if they did, they would never strike a deal. And if they struck a deal, they would never honor the deal. But nevertheless, it did all happen. And the question has often been raised, was there a better deal that could be found? There's a very famous gentleman who said that this is the worst deal ever. Was there a better deal that could be found? I think there was. There was a better deal that could be found. But that was a deal that could have been struck years ago. Not a deal that could have been struck in 2015. 2003, the Iranians sent a proposal to the Bush administration through the Swiss ambassador in Tehran, who was tasked with giving the U.S. messages from the Iranians and send them to the Iranians. They offered to open up the nuclear program for complete transparency. They had about 160 or so centrifuges at the time. To collaborate with the United States against Al-Qaeda in Iraq, to even indirectly recognize Israel. The Bush administration did not even respond to that proposal. I think I told this story last time I was here, but let me tell it again. I was working in Congress at the time. The Swiss ambassador used to come to my boss because he had lived in Iran before and he spoke Farsi and was the most knowledgeable person in Congress about Iran. He gave us a copy of the proposal. My boss sent it to the White House to Karl Rove. Karl Rove called back within 2 hours. He said that he found it intriguing. He asked if it was authentic. My boss said, yes, it came from the Swiss. And then we never heard anything about it. Until about 2 or so months later, It was a story in the Financial Times that the Iranians had given some form of a nuclear negotiation offer to the U.S. side. And the Bush administration's response was to punish the Swiss ambassador for having delivered it in the first place. 2005, right before Ahmadinejad becomes president, March of that year, the Iranians were negotiating with the Europeans. A last negotiation offer was sent to the Europeans before those talks ended. And this offer is actually online available. You can look it up. In which the Iranians offered to cap their nuclear program at 3,000 centrifuges. The Europeans never sent the proposal to the Bush administration because they knew that it would be rejected out of hand because it was 3,000 centrifuges too many. It wasn't compatible with the zero enrichment objective. I remember in one of the sessions at the White House, someone raised a question about that proposal and said, can we get back to that? And one of the U.S. nuclear negotiators kind of threw up her hands and said, look, we would love to get back to that proposal, but that ship has sailed. We were constantly chasing the deal we could have gotten 2 years ago. But back then, we were having too strong of demands. Incidentally, in one of my sessions with Zarif, I asked him, do you remember that 2005 proposal in which you said that you would cap it at 3,000? He chuckled and said, yeah, that was just an opening offer. We would have settled for 1,000 centrifuges. But, and remember what we had now, 22,000 centrifuges. The deal that Obama struck reduced the number of centrifuges in Iran to 5,000. After all of the sanctions, we get a deal that actually has more centrifuges than what we could have gotten in 2003 or 2005. But nevertheless, that is still reducing it with two-thirds. Their stockpile reduced by 98%. The Iranians have less than 300 kilos, meaning that they don't have enough material in their own soil that they could build a nuclear weapon. That is some of the things that have been achieved by the deal. But there's something more important that actually the deal opened up for in the long term, in my view. And that is it opened up the path for an all-inclusive security dialogue for the region. Not an order defined by Iran because they were now recognized by this deal, but a dialogue that would include the Saudis, the Iranians, and everyone else to find a way for the powers of the region to share the region, just as much as that is what's happened in Europe and elsewhere in the world, to get the Middle East out of this vicious cycle that it is in right now. And it was an opportunity for the United States to also lose Iran as an enemy. It would not be a quick process. It's taken a decade to build up this enmity, and it's going to take a couple of years to unwind it. But the door had been opened for it. And in my view, it is precisely that door that President Trump slammed shut when he went to Saudi Arabia and he called for Iran's all-out isolation. That was precisely why the Saudis and the Israelis were very happy about that trip. They cheered it because it was ending the path for diplomacy with Iran and reigniting the enmity between the United States and Iran. While a door was opened for a U.S.-Iran war, one that once again would change the balance of power in the region, and from the calculation of those in Riyadh, would be very beneficial for Saudi Arabia. Clearly, some feared the United States losing Iran as an enemy far more so than they feared Iran's nuclear program. And as that Israeli official said at that meeting, this was never about enrichment. Thank you so much.
Since you won a prize for ideas improving world order, could you give us one?
I knew that prize would raise the bar and end up biting me in the back. I think it's very important to recognize that at the end of the day, as dark as it may look right now in the Middle East, and we should not in any way, shape, or form belittle it, if we have a historical perspective, we can look back at a time in which in Europe there were far more bloodshed, far more fighting. If you take a look at the Middle East and compare it to Europe, you have more ethnic groups in Europe, you have more languages in Europe than what you have in the Middle East. Yet, Europe did manage to transition from a balance of power paradigm to a collective security paradigm. And it did so very much as a result of the help of the United States. It's not going to be easy for the Middle East to do so, but it's going to be next to impossible if no one is pushing to go in that direction. What we're doing right now, I fear, is that we're going back and taking sides. And it's not even clear to me the basis of taking sides. One thing that I thought was so problematic with the president's trip is that it coincided with the same day as the Iranians went to elect a new president or to participate in their elections. Their elections by no means are free and fair. But despite the tremendous obstacles the Iranians have had, they have now three times in a row elected the most moderate person that was put on the ballot. The Saudis have not had any elections to begin with. And many other countries in the region say they want peace, but they keep on electing more and more hardline governments. At that moment, to go and stand next to the Saudis, who don't have any elections, don't care about that, and call for an all-out isolation of Iran, I think missed a huge opportunity. I think we have a focus that is very much centered on governments. I think we need to have a focus that balances that by also looking at societies. Ultimately, it's not governments that are going to drive countries in a more moderate or less moderate direction, a more extreme or less extreme. The societies have a say in this. And in Iran right now, you have a society that, despite all of its significant undemocratic obstacles in front of them, are constantly pushing for more moderation. That doesn't mean we should forget all the negative things the Iranians are doing, but it means that we have a force inside of Iran that actually wants to move closer to the United States. The election of Rouhani, in this second election, he specifically said that he wanted to negotiate away the rest of the sanctions. What does that mean? He wanted to negotiate with the United States over the other issues that the U.S. and Iran have differences over and find a diplomatic solution. Our response was, we're just going to go with an all-out isolation while hugging the Saudis. I think this is going to create a tremendous amount of problems in the region, and I fear that a lot of those problems are going to come back here to American soil as well.
Where does this worst deal ever go from here? What do you think is going to happen under the Trump presidency to our relationship with Saudi Arabia, our relationship with Qatar, and obviously our relationship with Iran?
President Trump started off saying that he is going to renegotiate this deal. And having sat through much of that, I can tell you, I saw no evidence whatsoever that any of these countries would want to go through this experience again. It was one of those sessions when I think it was the French again who had procrastinated or something. The Russian foreign minister, Lavrov, who's on a usual day pretty grumpy to begin with, just came down to the lobby infuriated. And his security personnel essentially evacuated most of the lobby and the bar, and then he went there and ordered a full bottle of vodka. Go back to them and ask them to do this for another 2 years. There's just no basis to be able to achieve that. I think the administration right now, if I were to give a rather dark assessment of what they're trying to do, is I think they're trying to kill the deal while appearing to adhere to it. So on the one hand, there's a certification that Iran is complying with the deal, which the State Department had to certify because the IEA had said so. But the day after this, Tillerson comes out and gives the most hostile, venomous rhetoric against the Iranians. We have an issue in which the waivers, every 120 or 180 days, the U.S. has to waive sanctions as part of the deal, as long as the Iranians are in compliance. The waivers were done, but immediately afterwards, the president goes to Saudi Arabia and calls for Iran's all-out isolation. This deal was fragile enough as it was. If we have this constant attempt to push it and to test it here and there, eventually, I think it will collapse. The calculation, and this has actually been articulated by some people close to Trump, is to do this not so that the U.S. is in violation, because as long as the U.S. continues to certify and continues to waive the sanctions, it's technically not in violation, but to just provoke, and make sure that the Iranians don't get the benefits of being in compliance, after which they will no longer see the need to be in compliance. Because every time the U.S. goes out and says Iran needs to be completely isolated, what signal does that send to companies who were thinking to go into the Iranian market? The sanctions have been lifted, so they're legally allowed to go in. But then Trump says, oh, we have to completely isolate Iran. Well, those companies paid a heavy price walking out of Iran when the sanctions were first imposed. They're staying out of Iran now as a result of this. If the Iranians then are not getting the benefit of being in compliance, the calculation is that they will be out of compliance soon. And they will walk out of the deal, they'll get the blame for it, they'll pay the price for it. This is my fear, and I've not seen anything yet that would indicate otherwise. And I think it's really important to recognize that if this happens, then we will be back in the scenario we were in 2012 and 2013, in which the Iranians will restart their nuclear program. They will inch closer towards having that nuclear capacity to build the bomb, build more centrifuges, and we will be back at a point in which the choice increasingly will be accept an Iranian nuclear bomb or go to war.
Do you believe that Iran and Saudi Arabia will eventually go to war? And if that happens, what impact will that have on the Middle East as a whole?
Saudi Arabia and Iran are in some ways already at war, whether it is in Syria or whether it is in Yemen or elsewhere. There's a proxy war. I don't find it very likely that the Saudis would want to go into direct confrontation. Now, the Saudis have a military budget that is about 6 times the size of the Iranian. But they have shown after 3 years of warfare in Yemen that they're not that good. And as a result, I doubt that they would want to have a direct confrontation. And even the Israelis, who are very, very militarily powerful, didn't want to have a direct confrontation if they wanted anything at all. And Ehud Barak said that in an interview 2 months ago. The idea was to start something that the U.S. would be forced to enter, because the U.S. is the only military power that can actually really have a quick, or at least be able to achieve some of those military objectives. So if anything, it would be more likely that we're going to see an escalation in Syria. We're seeing that right now, incidentally, that has no authorization by Congress. It's a slippery slope, and eventually it will lead to a larger war, and it would be very difficult for the United States to stay out of it.
Okay, and here's a question about a major country we really haven't mentioned. You mentioned earlier in your talk. What impact has this had on Russian influence in the Middle East? Where does Russia play now, and where will they play in the future?
The Russians are looking at the Middle East, and they're looking in many different places, and they're seeing opportunity after opportunity. Take a look what happened with Qatar now. The Saudis are turning on the Qataris as an effort to be able to silence any opposition within the Arab camp against their line on Iran and other issues as well. Then Trump goes out and endorses this while his State Department is strongly opposing it. It sends these conflicting messages and it creates opportunities. So now the Turks are sending troops to Qatar, the Iranians are sending food to Qatar and are improving their relations with Qatar, and the Russians are seeing more and more opportunities. There was a lot of talk about that Obama was not showing strong leadership. If you take a look at what is happening right now, if there was a calculation that being unpredictable will be a deterrent against U.S. enemies, what is done more than anything else is that it's caused a lot of U.S. allies to feel that the U.S. is so unpredictable right now so that they need to have a really good plan B. And that plan B tends to be Iran or Russia. Who else are they going to turn to? And ultimately, in my view, that is not serving U.S. interests.
Okay, you mentioned the action against Qatar. What sense do you make of the Saudis and the rest of the Arab Emirates gagging up against Qatar? What's the point of all this? Is it actually aimed at Iran?
There's many different reasons behind this, probably, and it's been very difficult to be able to really establish 2 or 3 clear motives behind this. I think what we can say, it is not. It is not because the Saudis are horrified by Qatar's support for terrorism. That's the least likely of all of the things, mindful of the support that the Saudis themselves have been given to various groups. Let me just focus on the potential Iran angle. There is an Iran angle there, I believe. I don't know if it's at the center of it. I don't know if it's the most important of it, but it is there. Qatar is not a particularly powerful country. It's a very small country, population of, 400,000 indigenous. It obviously is very strong on the oil market, on the gas market in particular. But most importantly, it actually is a media superpower in the Arab language media because of Al Jazeera Arabic. If there were to be a confrontation between Saudi and Iran, or a larger confrontation that would take place, it would be critical for the Saudis to make sure that they are in control of the Arab narrative on that war. The media war, as we've learned now, is played out not just on the networks, it's played out on Twitter, it's played out on Facebook. Saudi Arabia had a very negative experience in this in 2006. When Israel and Hezbollah went to war, and the Saudis were indirectly supporting Israel. The Arab world ended up taking a completely different position, and Hezbollah became tremendously popular because it essentially wasn't defeated by the Israelis. And Al Jazeera and these Arab channels constituted a major problem for the Saudis to be able to get their narrative out. If you have a future war, I think the Saudis probably would like to make sure that their ability to control the Arab narrative is not going to be challenged. And right now, while Kuwait and Oman also do not share Saudi Arabia's obsession with Iran, none of them have that media capacity. None of them have that capacity to truly challenge Saudi narrative in the Arab world. Qatar does. And if you take a look at the 10-point conditions the Saudis gave to the Qataris for them to accept in order to be, for the siege to be lifted, the first one is that they have to completely cut off all ties to Iran. The second one is that they have to shut down Al Jazeera. And there's 8 more. Clearly, these are not conditions that they expect the Qataris to be able to say yes to. This is something I think that is done either to force them for a complete capitulation, which is unlikely, or push them further away. And if they are pushed into Iran's hands, which, you know, people will be like, well, that doesn't make sense. Well, it does, because it completely delegitimizes Al Jazeera in the eyes of the Saudis and many others. So it's a way of delegitimizing that voice prior to a larger confrontation. I'm speculating here. I want to be very clear. But if there is an Iran angle, I would suspect that this is the angle.
Okay. Now, I've got a couple of questions. I won't read them all. But where does Israel fit into this? For example, how does Israel now feel about the agreement reached with Iran in 2015? And how do you see Israel's impact going ahead on Iran and its relations with the United States?
So this might sound strange, but by mid-2015, it had become clear that Bibi Netanyahu had actually become the most valuable player for the team supporting the nuclear deal. That sounds strange because he was clearly the number one enemy of the deal. But he misplayed his hands in so many different ways that it really ended up supporting and helping the president get the deal through. He went to Congress to speak out against the deal, which was a rather unprecedented move. What that did, he presented no new information, no new argument. What that did is that it infuriated a lot of the Democrats and made the issue of Iran a more partisan issue, in which a vote in favor of the Iran deal would be a vote in favor of Obama and the Democratic Party, and a vote against the Iran deal would be a vote against your Democratic president and in favor of a foreign leader, Bibi Netanyahu. This made it much more difficult for the Democrats, even those who did not like the deal, to vote against the deal. Combine that then with something that he didn't have anything to do with, but that Senator Kaine and Corker had worked out a deal in which the way the deal would be voted on in the Senate was that it had to be actively rejected. It did not need to be affirmed. Meaning, as long as there wasn't 50 votes in favor of rejecting the deal would stand. Also, in order to get it to the floor, you had to have 40 votes in order to get it to the floor in order to be able to break any filibuster. You had 46 Democrats. You needed to make sure that at least 7 of them deserted and voted with the Republicans. After him giving that speech, that made it all more difficult. And in fact, the president managed to get 42 of those Democrats. There were probably 7 Democrats that were available. And after all of those campaigning and all of the money that was spent, Netanyahu ended up with less than what he began with. But the biggest of all mistakes that he did, was that he thought that by making Iran an existential threat and by making a diplomatic solution impossible by pushing for zero enrichment, he would force the United States to go to war. What instead happened is that by taking such an unrealistic position on the negotiations and making Iran an existential threat, he eliminated the option for the president to ignore the Iran issue or just kick the can down the road. The president had to do something on Iran. And because he didn't want to go to war, because he didn't believe that war would work, he was forced to go towards negotiations. Of all things that Netanyahu could have done to kill the deal, there was one very simple thing he could have done that he never thought of. All he needed to say was, this is a great deal. This is a huge humiliation of Iran. And he would have taken a victory lap around Congress. And I'm not speculating here. I asked Zarif, what would have happened if Netanyahu declared this deal a victory for Israel and a massive defeat for Iran? He said the negotiations would collapse immediately. Iran had no problem handling Netanyahu's opposition. In fact, the more fervent his opposition was, the stronger the negotiations team's hand became within Iran's internal politics. But if he had hugged the deal, it would have put the Iranian negotiators in a very, very difficult position internally.
That's a great commentary.
We hear that the people of Iran have positive feelings about the people of the United States. Is this true? If so, what's the significance? Can somehow the United States take advantage of this?
It is absolutely true. Let me put it this way. U.S. foreign policy and U.S. government is significantly criticized by average Iranians. So when I say that they tend to be pro-American, it's because they actually have a tremendous amount of respect for American values, for American culture. They love American culture. And they copycat the United States all the time for all of their slogans, etc. Let me put it, you all remember the Green Movement that was so brutally shut down by the Iranian regime. It was really fascinating seeing that movement. That movement eventually became victorious because that movement is the core of the supporters of Rouhani. They just changed color. Now they have purple before they were green. But it's the same thing. When they ran, the entire campaign videos, everything they were doing, was not just a copycat of American campaign videos, but very much a copycat of Obama's campaign videos. In fact, Mousavi's campaign slogan, guess what it was? Yes, we can. So for all of the governments blaming the United States and being so anti-American, which very much is also rooted because the United, and this is an, I'm glad you mentioned this, this is an important point. If the United States adopts a position that the Saudis and the Israelis want right now, which is to take a hard hegemonic position in the region, the United States once again is in control of the region, massive military presence, and sets the order for the region, assuming that the U.S. has the capacity to do so. By definition, this puts the United States at odds with the Iranians, whether it's this regime, the next regime, or the previous regime. Because the Iranians have a long-standing position of rejecting any external powers imposing their hegemony on the Middle East. They're not doing so for any particularly fuzzy or really admirable reasons. They're doing so because if there's no external powers in the region, Iran is one of the biggest powers in the region. And that will definitely benefit the Iranians. And this is something that doesn't change with regimes. Now, I tend to view that from the U.S. perspective, hard hegemony in the Middle East ultimately is no longer to the benefit of the United States. There was a time 30 years ago where the oil was more valuable, the region was less unstable, and the oil was even more valuable to some of the U.S.'s competitors. Now we have a situation in which the United States is the swing producer on the oil market if it chooses to be so because of the shale oil explosion. We have a situation in which it's no longer about sustaining an order, a stability between states. We have now three failed states in the region, and we'll have another couple within the next 2 years. The hegemon's main job is to maintain stability. Anything that goes wrong is your fault. A cat gets stuck on a tree in Baghdad, it's on you. So what is the cost-benefit analysis at this point to be the hegemon of the Middle East? What are the benefits? And what are the massively increased costs as a result of the fact that it's not just about maintaining stability between states, but actually making sure that the states themselves stand up and function? So the cost is overwhelming. And the Obama administration's calculation was that we were already overextended in the Middle East. The Middle East is not that important any longer for the U.S. to devote so much energy to it, because ultimately, 10, 20 years down the road, the real competitor, the real peer competitor to the United States, the country that could challenge the United States' global position as the sole superpower, is not going to emerge out of the Middle East. It's not going to be Iran, and rest assured, it's not going to be the Houthis. It's going to be China. And while we are so focused on the Middle East, with rising costs and dwindling returns, the Chinese are happily enjoying our distractions. So from that perspective, I find it very problematic if General Mattis gets what he wants, because I think Mattis very much would like to reestablish hard hegemony. I don't think it would work, and I don't think it would benefit the United States. But that automatically puts the U.S. and Iran in a colliding course. Other things that would undermine the goodwill that does exist right now amongst the Iranian people towards the United States are things such as calling for Iran's isolation when they are voting for greater openness, and they're opposing their hardliners and paying a high price for doing so, and then having the door shut on them. But also things such as the travel ban. The travel ban was supposed to keep the United States secure. 94.1% of all deaths in the United States caused by terrorism has been caused by citizens of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and UAE. None of those countries are on this list. I'm not saying they should be, because I don't think, as the Homeland Security has made clear, nationality is not a good predictor for terrorism. The country that is most affected by this is Iran. 58% of the potential visa applicants, based on 2015 figures, that are affected by this are Iranians. For them to be included and Saudi not to be included, rest assured, it took tremendous offense at this. Things like this, in the long run, can really destroy a tremendously valuable strategic asset we have in Iran that we frankly don't have in a lot of places in the Middle East right now, which is a population that genuinely likes the United States.
We always like to end on an upbeat note, Trita. But it doesn't look, when you consider that President Trump's first visit to any country in the world was to Saudi Arabia, it doesn't look as if we're backing out of being the hegemon in the Middle East anytime soon.
Let me say one thing on that. My two previous books were also like, oh my God, everything is going in the wrong direction. I wrote this book. I was so happy. I was like, finally, I can write about something that succeeded. I can finally show that there's something positive. And then I had to rewrite the last chapter after the election.
Many thanks for coming back again.